Arthur Taylor was 20 years old when he volunteered with the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment on the 3rd of September 1914, and he came from a small village, not in Northamptonshire, but over the border, near Stamford. He worked as a clerk when he decided to give up that comfortable job and join the colours. And same as everybody else, in the last week of July, on the 26th of July 1915, went over to France with his new mates. They landed at Boulogne. The regimental band played the Marseillaise. And after 10 months of training, it was time to go and take on the enemy, the German army. Arthur must have been apprehensive. They all must have been apprehensive, mustn't they? But at the same time, he'd been well trained, prepared. He was now fully clothed, fully uniformed. Had all his equipment with him, his mates around him, and he was ready to go. But at first, the Northamptonshires didn't find their way to the front line. They trained and marched around various areas behind the lines. There's Amiens in particular. And they carried on their vigorous day-to-day training, and they were inspected by General Munro, who was the officer in command of the 10th Army Corps, and they went into Corps Reserve. On August the 8th, Battalion and Arthur, they marched to fresh billets in a place called Bonnet. That was a route march of 13 miles. And on the 13th of August, they were uprouted again, and this time they marched closer to the front line, near the Somme River itself, a river at this stage they probably didn't even know the name of it, and they certainly didn't know what an important and infamous role in the history of the British Army that river was to give to the name of the famous battle, which was still nearly a year away. And it was at this stage that Arthur and his mates were given instructional tours of the actual frontline trenches. This was definitely a quiet zone at the time, and it was veterans of the 1st Battalion of the Surrey Regiment that gave them that information about where the Germans were, how wide no man's land was, whether there was weaknesses in the trench defence system. And in amongst them, these men laughed and joked with each other, but of course, behind those jokes, there were hidden thoughts of an unknown tomorrow. On the 14th of August at 2:30 p.m, two companies of the 6th Battalion, for the first time temporarily, took over an actual section of the frontline trenches. And then just 2 days later, they were relieved by the other two companies, A and B companies. And this process of moving companies in and out the line was standard procedure for the British Army. And 2 days later, they changed again. In the early hours, though, of the 19th of August, 1915, the battalion was to get its first casualty in action, killed in action. The official war diary, which I'm looking at now, it just says one thing, one killed, it says. That's all it says. It doesn't even mention the name of that soldier that died. But a quick look at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records, and it tells us that that man that died was Arthur Taylor from Stamford, that 20-year-old clerk who'd joined up nearly a year before with hopes of proudly beating the German army and returning home as a hero. None of that was to happen, because on their first spell in the trenches, it was Arthur that was to be that first casualty in action. He'd spent just 25 days in France and only 3 days on and off in the front line. I wonder how he died. Service record has survived the Blitz, which destroyed most of the British Army service records in the Second World War. There's bits of it still there. Gives us details of how high he was, how tall he was, 5 foot 4.5 inches. Lots of personal information, details of who his parents were. He wasn't married, he was a single man. It doesn't tell us what happened. Perhaps he was killed by a sniper. Perhaps he looked over the parapets, as so many of them did, only to be killed by an eagle-eyed sniper on the other side of no man's land. Or maybe he was killed by shellfire, or maybe he was killed in an accident. There's lots of different ways of being killed on the Western Front. I shouldn't think we'll ever know what happened to Arthur. He was originally buried in the cemetery well behind the lines at Corby, but he's now buried in Cerisi Gaeli Military Cemetery, not far from where he died. It's 10 kilometres southwest of Owlbear, the main British base town. And this was where there was a casualty clearing station, but not until 1917. And it's one of those cemeteries that after the war, some of the smaller cemeteries were closed down and their graves moved to this location where there's now 745 Commonwealth burials and commemorations from the Great War, of which 114 of those are unidentified. And there's special memorials that commemorate five casualties that were buried at Maricourt and St. Helene, but their graves could not be found after the war. It's a cemetery that I've not yet been to, but I will go there at some stage when I visit the Somme. Won't take long to drive down there from our billet in La Boisselle. I'll go and see Arthur and pay my respects. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this is the third episode of a series of podcasts that we're doing following a typical volunteer British Army battalion on the Western Front from their enlistment in 1914 through their training in 1915. And in this third episode, they've now arrived on the Somme on the Western Front in the autumn and summer and autumn of 1915. They're beginning their build-up to what they don't know yet, but it is to be the great push, the great offensive, which we now call the Battle of the Somme. And we're going to follow their story in subsequent episodes right the way through that Battle of the Somme into 1917, the Battle of Boom Ravine, the last action on the Somme. We're going to follow them up then to Ypres via Arras, and we're going to finish their story on in 1918 during the German Spring Offensive and the final 100 days, and then back to Northampton. And the idea is that this will give you, regardless of where you're from, an idea of what a typical battalion went through during the course of the 4 years. And during that period, as we've just done there with Arthur Taylor, we're going to be looking at individual stories of these soldiers that had come, in this case, from the shoe factories in Northampton and the surrounding towns and villages. So picking up their story in August of 1915, they've lost Arthur Taylor, being their first battlefield casualty. And in early September of 1915, they received their first new draft. 10 men joined the battalion. These were the first of these drafts that would arrive from England in the months to come as the battalion was brought up to full strength. And of course, they needed to replace men like Taylor that had become casualties. They then moved in to an area opposite the German-held village of Fricourt in a section that was known as D1. And as usual, they were holding that line with two companies in the trenches and two in reserve. The battalion diary tells us that when they were in the lines between the 9th and the 16th of September, so that's a week, that there was considerable activity on both sides of the wire. The enemy exploded two mines on our front and retaliated, one mine being blown underneath the Germans. They then had to repair the parapets to the trenches. The damage was severe, and total casualties were 7 men killed and 14 wounded, the weather being fine and warm. Now, this was their first experience of mine warfare. They hadn't yet met a German, they hadn't seen a German, they hadn't gone over the top. They were just holding the line, and as I mentioned earlier, this was a quiet zone during this period, the summer and autumn of 1915. And as we shall see as we move through the war, and as many of you probably know, mining was a method of breaking the built defences of an enemy. And this goes back, it's a tactic that had been used for centuries. The Egyptians were known to have undermined city walls of their enemies, and that was as long ago as 850 BC. And mining became a standard tactic in siege warfare. And it was developed over the centuries. And by the end of 1914, as the opposing forces faced each other across no man's land in this stalemate that was to last for nearly 4 years, mining was to become more and more important as both sides dug tunnels and blew mines, as we saw here, under each other. And these mines at this stage would have been quite small, but it must have been very uneasy, mustn't it, knowing or suspecting that your enemy was not just looking at you across no man's land, but possibly digging below you and with the intention of blowing up the trenches and you and your mates. And here, as we saw from the battalion diary, there were 7 men killed. This underground war we're going to look at in more detail in future podcasts. I read somewhere there was as many as 25,000 men being employed by the British alone in this underground war. The chalk ground of the Somme was ideal for mining. And of course there was the danger that these men that were doing the actual tunnelling were going to meet each other underground. They were using pickaxes and hands, their own hands, and bayonets to cut through the chalk to limit noise, because they could actually hear each other doing this underground. Secrecy was obviously important, and it's said that tunnelling could be heard in clay further north around the Ypres area from 100 metres away, and even further where it was chalk, nearly 250 metres away, it's said that tunnellers could hear each other. The British miners wore plimsolls sometimes and even barefoot. The Germans remained a lot of the time in their hobnail boots. And if they did meet each other underground, then of course all hell would break out. There would be a fight. They would use what they call camouflage, small explosions underground to blow up and cave in enemy galleries. There was all sorts of dreadful things could happen underground. And this incident in the second week of September 1915 was to be the Northampton's first experience of this underground warfare. But it wasn't to be the last. If you visit the Fricourt area now, a number of these mine craters can still be seen. Some of them are on private grounds. There's an area called the Tambu mine craters. You can still see many of those craters from outside, especially during the winter months when the vegetation is not there. But what we can't tell by reading these accounts or looking at what's left of those mine craters is the sheer terror that they must have created on both sides of the wire. And as we'll see in a minute, as September turned into October, turned into November, the situation with mining was to get a lot worse for the county regiments and the boys of Northamptonshire. Now, before we go on and see what happened in November of 1915, let's have a look at something that happened at home. One of those men from the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshires. And his name was Arthur Jacobs. And he'd been a career soldier before the First World War, joining up when he was 18 years old. When his service ended, he went back to his home in Wellingborough. And in 1911, he got married to a lady called Annie Clark, who at that time was 21 years old. And they set up home in Wellingborough. And in April of 1914, Annie gave birth to a little girl. But when war was declared in August, a few months later, Arthur was recalled from reserve and he joined the 1st Battalion of the Northamptonshires and went out to the Western Front. On the 30th of August of 1914, but on New Year's Day, on 1915, 1st of January, he returned home suffering from frostbite. He was treated in hospital and then he returned home to Wellingborough to see Annie and his little girl, who at this time was, 7, 8 months old. His service record tells us that having recovered from frostbite, he was sent to the depot of the Northamptonshire Regiment and joined the 6th Battalion, and the idea was he was preparing to return to the Western Front and join the 6th North Ants, as we know at this time was around the Fricourt area on the Somme. But when he went home, he discovered something that changed his life, because there was many Welshmen doing their basic training in and around Northampton and the county towns at that time. And when Arthur went home, he discovered that one of those Welshmen, a Sergeant Welton, was having an affair with Annie. The newspaper tells us he had reasons to suspect that his wife was having this affair. So on the 6th of June, with his sister and brother-in-law, he went at midnight to his wife's house and proceeded very quietly upstairs. And there in a bedroom, he found his wife with Welton together. And pulling the latter from the bed, he says he gave him a good hiding. Jacob's sister told the divorce court what happened in the bedroom. Mrs. Jacobs, when tackled about the matter, said she'd been boozed a bit and that's why she did it. It turns out that Welton and Mrs. Jacobs had been seen out and about on the streets of Wellingborough, and that's how Arthur became aware of what was going on. When Welton himself was asked about it, he said, "I've got no defence. I thought the husband was away," he said. He said that Jacobs had set about him and given him a good hiding. He said it was a blinking good cop. A divorce was quite rare in those days. Costs were awarded against Mrs. Jacobs and custody of the child was awarded to Arthur. By the time the court had made its decision, Arthur had returned to the Western Front. He went back on the 26th of July 1915. So he would have been present when these mines were blown beneath the Northamptonshire's positions. He was discharged from the service on the 28th of October 1915, just after this decree was issued and custody of the daughter given to him. His service record says he was discharged upon termination of his engagement, and I wonder whether in the exceptional circumstances the army sent him home to look after his young daughter. Now, of course, my mind then turned to Phyllis and what happened to her, and I was hoping to find a good ending, a good story for her life. And I did find one, Phyllis Jacobs, that was married for 60 years to the same man, born in the same month. And I thought, oh, is that her? It wasn't, unfortunately. The date of birth was wrong. But I did find a record for Phyllis Jacobs, who was born on the 24th of April 1914. It was in that 1939 register that was taken just before the Second World War. And it finds her not married, not at home, in Wellingborough with her dad, but in what was called the Rampton State Institution in Nottinghamshire, a facility that had been opened in 1912 as a criminal lunatic asylum. And at that time, she would have been 25 years old. I can't find any more details about Phyllis after that date. I wonder whether she was ever released from there. And I don't know what happened to her father either. I can't find any more records about him. It's a mystery. Maybe at some stage we'll find out. So let's go back now and find out what the 6th North Ants were doing. And in October, they were basically in and out the trenches in the same sector, the D1 sector near Fricourt. Casualties were extremely light during that month. Just one man killed and three wounded on the 29th of October and two more wounded on the 30th. And then that takes us into November and the weather is now beginning to change. The battalion diary once again gives us some details of more mine warfare. Between November the 10th and the 18th, two mines fired by the enemy, one on the 15th and one on the 17th. Total casualties, four killed, seven wounded. Outside the mines, with their disastrous effects on the morale of the battalion, lay another hazard, almost as bad, in the form of mud and rats. One had only to put one's foot in the wrong direction to be stuck fast in a stinking conglomeration of glutinous mud from which, without assistance, it was sheer impossibility to extricate oneself. As for the rats, they were law unto themselves, and after a time the lads came to accept the age-old philosophy. If you can't beat them, join them. Many a man swallowed his feelings of revulsion and gave the rodents fancy names, feeding them with titbits and treating them as family pets. Ask any of the survivors of those days, as I've asked myself, what is your most vivid memory of the war? And 9 times out of 10, the answer will be the mines, mud and rats of that first winter. That passage I was reading there comes from a book that's unpublished, that's a vital source of information for me, and it's called The Glorious Six, The History of the 6th Service Battalion, and written in 1975 by a man called Peter Jackson. And I found out more about their experiences of that mine warfare in November of 1915 by turning to a book that has been published by a man called W.H. Holloway, Northamptonshire and the Great War, 1914 to 1918, and he entitled a chapter which he called The Daily Dread of Mines. Not surprising, really, is it? And he talks about, at this stage, being the scandalous shortage of shells, which eventually was to cost the Commander-in-Chief, Sir John French, his job. But that's another story. And it says that because they didn't have enough bombs, they were practising bombing using turnips. And they attended the village church at Morlincourt, which was their billet when they were out of the line. And the church itself was used for concerts, boxing and a church service on Sunday evenings. It says that this was a very trying period, sufficient to shake the stoutest nerves, for the Germans had laid many mines in close proximity and our men were in almost constant danger of being blown up without warning. Scarcely a week passed without such an upheaval, and 1 week 5 mines exploded, so that eventually no man's land began to resemble a huge crater. We could do little in response but sit still and nurse our wrath at the scarcity of ammunition, for they would send over showers of shells and we could only reply with 2 or 3. An exciting incident illustrates what happened one day. There was a captain and adjutant, Beecham. He took a runner with him. A Major Beecham, who was the adjutant, took a runner with him and went up to the front line post to locate the mortar that was firing at us and causing trouble. And the plan was they were going to have it knocked out by the artillery. He succeeded in locating the place and sent the runner back to the telephone dugout with a message to the gunners to fire one round, giving the map reference as near as possible. Soon afterwards, the shell came over. "Go back and tell the gunners to fire another round 100 yards to the right," said Captain Beecham. After the second shell was fired, the adjutant again sent back a message to the artillery to lengthen their range 50 yards. Over came the third shell, but it was not quite on the spot. "Tell them to fire another round 20 yards to the right and we've got it," said Beecham. Back went the runner with the message again. Then the reply came over the wire. "Is this really necessary, as we've only got 2 more rounds to last until Friday?" The answer was duly delivered to the adjutant. "For God's sake, tell them to keep them," he replied. "We might have an SOS tonight." For his work on that day, Captain Beecham was awarded the Military Cross, and there was a private ploughman. He got the Distinguished Conduct Medal. Shellfire, snipers, bullets and mining activities continued to take an almost daily toll of life or limb. There was a Lieutenant Lambert. He and 3 men were being killed and 5 wounded in 1 mine explosion. If you go to that point now, there's a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery called Point 110 Old Military Cemetery at Freecourt. This was a cemetery that was named after a contour on the map. There's 100 Commonwealth burials of the First World War there. Three of them are unidentified. There were some French graves there, but they were removed after the war and are now buried in the French National Cemetery at Albert. And many of those men that were killed in the mine warfare in the autumn of 1915 are buried there, including the officer mentioned there, James Edward Lambert, who was just 20 years old. I found some information about him in the newspaper archives and tells us that he was educated at Bedford School between 1909 and 1914. He represented that school with distinction in football, cricket, running, fencing, and he was a sergeant in the OTC, the Officer Training Corps, and a leading monitor in the house and the school. He took his officer examinations at Woolwich in 1913, but then rather than joining the army, he resolved to take holy orders, and he was due to enter Magdalene College at Oxford in October 1914, but it was at that stage that he joined the army and became an officer. The article says that he was thorough, cheerful and fearless and became an excellent officer. He was sent forward on the 9th of November the 1st with a party of bombers to cover an extension of our trenches. It was a position of danger, his colonel wrote, but he was always the first to volunteer for anything of this sort, the bravest of the brave. He says they came under heavy rifle fire and he ordered his men to go back under his sergeant and he stayed out himself to cover their retreat when he was shot through the head. Now that story is different to the one that's in this book by Holloway. It says that he was one of the men that was killed during a mine explosion. But either way, he died on the 1st of November 1915 and he's buried in that cemetery near Freecourt. Actually, looking at the battalion diary for that period, which is neatly handwritten, the diary does say that three mines were fired on that evening of the 1st of November. And it says about the casualties and Lambert being one of them, but it doesn't actually say he was killed in that mine explosion. So it looks as though the book may be wrong. And of course, the eyewitness account from his colonel that wrote Hopes and the Family tells us what happened to him, that he was shot through the head and hopefully died instantaneously, but who knows. I found a photo of young James Lambert and I'll post that on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. By now, of course, these men had got so used to each other, having been through a year of training, eatings and living together and now being on the battlefield together. And this was the whole idea of the Powell's battalions, that a lot of these men would have played sport together, worked together and lived in the same streets together in Northampton in the years before the war. And the idea was that it would help their morale when things got tough. And we've got evidence of that it was working with the six North Ants. Because another one of those men that is buried in Point 110 Old Cemetery was called Private William Whitehead. And he died on the 15th of September 1915 at the age of 24. And he came from the small village of Wappenham, which is near Toaster, in the south end of Northamptonshire. So he was one of the very first ones to die during that series of mine explosions. And it was Captain Podmore that wrote home to his family. He says, "Ever since I came to this company, I've had a special liking for this little group of men from Wappenham. Every one of them strong, hearty fellows. That little band from Wappingham, of which your son was one, has been absolutely invaluable in keeping the rest of their platoon always cheerful. I've been so struck with this Wappenham spirit that I'm determined, if I get home, to come over and see the parents who have produced such splendid sons." Podmore consoled the family, in assuring them that young William had been shot through the head and died instantaneously. At home in Wappenham, he was a member of the church choir and also a bell ringer, and he was employed on the railways at the Wolverton Carriage Works. Podmore said that he was one of the best shots in the company and therefore entrusted with the important job of sniping, in the performance of which he was killed. One of those other officers that we mentioned earlier on was Second Lieutenant, promoted to Temporary Captain, R.W. Beecham. He'd been transferred from the West Yorkshire Regiment to the North Ants. And his citation says, "After the explosions of the enemy mines on the 28th of September 1915, he went out on his own initiative, investigated the newly formed craters coming under fire at close range. He then returned, organised a working party, pegged out a new line and completed a new trench under fire. His gallant example gave confidence to the working party and the new trench now forms an important addition to the defensive of this section." There was a Private S. Jackson of the 6 North Ants. He died on the 2nd of November at the age of 24 and had been with the battalion since August. He was one of those new drafts. Previously, he'd worked at the Manfield & Sons shoe factory. He'd got two brothers that had signed up. And the reason I'm mentioning him is because he came from a street called Clouksham Street. Now, Clouksham Street is still there. And it's a street where well over 100 soldiers signed up. And at the last count, well over 20 of them failed to return, a bit like Jackson here. It's a typical street, terraced houses with cellars, built in the late Victorian age to provide accommodation for the workers in the boot and shoe industry. But a street that keeps cropping up in my research time after time after time. And as we go forward, we'll find more and more soldiers from this street that went off to the battlefields and didn't come back. And even this house, number 46, Clouchham Street, is to crop up again. So November gave way to December. Looking at the battalion diary, once again, at the beginning of the month, they're out of the line and at Morlancourt in rest billets. They then spend 7 days back in those familiar trenches opposite the Germans in Free Corps, and then 2 weeks even further back out of the line. But on Christmas Eve 1915, they relieved the 11th Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers, found themselves back in the frontline trenches again. The men's thoughts centred on home and their loved ones. But never for one moment, Jackson says in his book, did they forget the purpose for which they were there, or admit the possibility of a premature, inglorious defeat. Christmas Eve was quiet, there being little enemy activity. Nevertheless, orders for the day were as follows. If the enemy shows any desire to fraternise, shoot, and the word shoot is in capital letters. That's a nod, of course, to what had happened with the regular British Army 12 months earlier and the famous truce that we've covered in at least two other podcasts before. There was no way that was going to happen this year. There was too much blood had been spilt, and obviously the higher command didn't want that to happen either. It had rained, it had rained and rained and rained, and it must have been so miserable for those men in those trenches. And on the 27th, when it was still raining, the artillery used a fortnight's supply of ammunition by firing some 800 shells into the German trenches in and around Free Corps. And I've got here in front of me a letter that was sent home from the trenches by a man called Private Leonard W. Scott of the 6th North Ants. He's obviously replying to a letter that someone sent to him, because he says, I received your letter, a nice parcel, just before we went into the trenches on the usual sporting expedition. Bit ironic, really. Sporting expedition, that's one way of calling it. I therefore decided I would not open the letter until we arrived there, for I knew I should be hungry by that time, especially after the march from the old barn in the village with the home on one's back. Home, he means, his backpack with all his stuff in. The cake was special and went down like a dream. I was on the post in the trench just a few yards from the Germans just at tea time, and with a drop of tea they brought along and a good slice of that cake, I made a very nice tea indeed. I bet some of those blooming Huns would have envied me. Can't you see me, sitting there in all the mud and water, but eating a jolly good tea? I can assure you the Germans did not worry me much at the time. We came out of the trenches yesterday after a desperate struggle. You've had a terrible lot of rain here just lately, and it's made the trenches like young rivers. In some parts we were right up to our thighs, and we had about a mile and a half of communication trench to go through. It was a tedious job. Some of our chaps got stuck in the mud, and we had a good laugh while pulling them out. We're all merry and bright out here and cheerful. We shall spend Christmas Day in the trenches as we go back again on Christmas Eve. I wonder what games the Germans will try and play this Christmas. I don't think it will do for any of them to show themselves too much. Christmas came and went. Their first Christmas in those trenches. Their first Christmas away from home. They'd now been on the Western Front for 5 months. 32 men had been killed. Quite a light number, really. More than that, wounded, of course. There was a lot more to happen in 1916. Of course there was. The Battle of the Somme was approaching. They didn't know it then. And what they also didn't know, that something else was ahead of them in just a couple of days. It was the 29th of December 1915. It's a day that barely gets a mention in any of the history books, that I'm looking at the two history books and the battalion diary. Because it was this day, between Christmas and New Year, that those lads from Northamptonshire were the victims of a new form of attack. Things went wrong that night. Badly wrong. They were to lose more casualties that night than in the previous 5 months of the war put together. There was to be an inquiry into what happened that night as to how the Germans were able to breach the defences, get into the Northamptonshire trenches and cause so much havoc and so many casualties. But that's a story I'm going to save for episode 4 of this podcast, because it's such a big story, really. Not in the context of the war, but in the context and history of the Northamptonshire, the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshires. So much was to happen that night. I think it deserves a podcast of its own, and we'll return and tell that story in a few weeks' time. But for now, thank you very much once again for tuning in to the podcast. Means I'm not sitting here talking to myself, doesn't it? By the time you listen to this, I shall be out on the Western Front with the Army Benevolent Fund on the annual frontline walk. We've got about 50 people doing the walk this year, where we start at the Lochnagar crater and we end 3 days later and 100k later at the Menin Gate. And my role this year will be to act as a roaming guide. I'll be out on my electric push bike, cycling around, showing photographs and telling stories of what happened on the Western Front along the route that we're following. It's the 11th year that we've done this frontline walk, and we've raised, I think we're getting on towards £2 million now. There must be at least 350, 400 people that have done it over the years, some more than once, some just once. But if you fancy doing it, it's an experience that you'll never forget. It's extremely challenging, both mentally and physically. But you get to see the battlefields close up. You get the opportunity to raise lots of money for the Army Benevolent Fund, the national charity of the British Army. And you make friendships a bit like the soldiers did in the trenches that you'll keep forever as you all go through that pain, both emotionally and physically, as I said, of walking sometimes over 20 miles a day for 3 consecutive days. If you really are interested in doing this, I do recommend it. And go to the Army Benevolent Fund's website. You'll type in frontline walk, and you'll find not just the walk across the Western Front, but several other walks in Italy and Crete and Normandy as well. And if you're interested in any of those, you can sign up and get involved. But for now, I'll sign off and remind you once again, if you possibly can, to rate and review the podcast wherever you download it from, in particular on Apple and Spotify. They seem to be the two most favourite platforms. And we end by remembering those 32 men that died in those first few months of the Northamptons experience on the Western Front. We end by playing The Last Post.